Welcome back to the second hour of Better Lawns and Gardens from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. I'm Teresa Watkins. I'm a landscape designer, garden author, horticulturist. I love helping people with their plants, and I love helping and answering gardening questions. And if today is a pre-recorded brand new show, but please hold your calls until next week. We'd love to talk to you then. We're going to get John
Denver.
And
now it's time for the dirty word of the day.
I'm sorry. Let's do that again. I'm sorry. Go ahead and just start, John Denver.
And now it's time for the dirty word of the day on Better Lawns and Gardens with Teresa Watkins.
The dirty word of the day is a phrase, part sun, part shade. We see this all the time on plants, partial sun, partial shade. What does it mean? Part sun is defined as 4 to 6 hours of direct sun per day. Not all those hours need to be accrued consecutively. It could mean a few hours of morning sun plus a few more in the afternoon. It may be that the southeast side of your house is in part sun. When a plant prefers part sun, although it does not need to be in direct sun all day, it will grow and bloom best with at least some of those hours being in the afternoon. The plants need some heat and intense sun exposure in order to produce flowers and new growth. So what is part shade? Part shade is also defined as 4 to 6 hours of direct sun per day, but most of that should come in the morning hours when the sun's rays are less intense. We say that plants which prefer part shade enjoy cool sun, meaning direct sun in the morning or evening and protection from the hot midday sun. It may be that the east side of your house is in part shade. So that is the definition of part sun, part shade. It means just a few hours of direct sun, but mostly shade. If the plant blooms better in full sun, then that's called part sun. If it blooms better in the part shade or thrives better in the shade, that's called partial shade. So now you know in the dirty word of the day. So
now I feel so much more intelligent.
I don't know about that.
That's saying a lot. So wait. Let's see. How would we use that dirty word of the day in a sentence?
Well, your turkeys. Okay. Turkeys enjoy part sun and part shade.
This is true.
You know, depending on the time of the year, probably in the wintertime, they like more part shade or part sun. And in the summertime, they like more part shade.
There you go. Okay. Thank you. Now I know how to use it.
There you go. And turkeys are just the best pets, aren't they, Lizzie?
And they taste good too.
Well, in the middle of summertime, we have a lot of insect issues. And this year, we're seeing chinch bug issues, sod webworm issues are everywhere. But you also want to check for mealybugs and billbugs and nematodes. If you have zoysia lawn, nematodes can be an issue. And what you can take is a nematode assay test. Okay, this is available at your extension office in your local county extension. And you go in and ask, tell them that you have a zoysia lawn and that you think it is nematodes. Now, the reason I say that is because when zoysia grass dies or turns brown, it's generally thought that it needs more water. That's not true. You have to determine whether it's an insect issue or a watering issue. And zoysia grass, if it doesn't get enough water, will turn brown. But the minute you irrigate it or you get rainfall, it will green right up. So if it's raining like it is now and you have zoysia grass that is brown, it is not a watering issue. It is either an insect issue, a nematode issue, or it is a disease issue. And the disease issue could happen because of large patch, which happens in the summertime. And it just means that you've gotten a fungal issue in the zoysia and it needs to dry out. Once you have a fungus, you cannot get rid of it. Okay, you have to prevent it. So that's why we talk about overwatering so much on the radio show, is because that's the major issue of plants and grass in Florida. So it's important for you to know that just because it's brown doesn't mean it needs water. Okay, that's very, very, very important. So we are going to come back. We have with us Ellen Zakos. She is a prolific garden writer. She has 11 books out. She has a new one that is out this year. It is a wonderful book. Everyone knows I love to read books, and Ellen's is delightful. We're going to have her on, and she is going to discuss her new book, Mythic Plants, Poisons and Potions from the Gods. And it is a great book, and so I'm looking forward to that.
Well, it kind of gets you in the spirit of the fall and Halloween coming up also.
It is. It's just great. But all these plants, I learn new words. It's just, I love trivia. So
yes.
It was one of those books that I could not read. I just was able to read right through. I loved it. So she is coming on with us, and we're going to be back from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. If it's Saturday morning, you're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins. Today you're listening to a brand new pre-recorded show for your enjoyment. Please hold all calls. We'll be back next week. Today with me, joining me, is Ellen Zakos. She is a Harvard graduate and the author of 11 books, including How to Forage for Wild Edible Plants Without Dying, and The Forager's Pantry, The Wild Crafted Cocktail, and Growing Healthy Houseplants, so many more. Ellen was named a Great American Garden by our own Epcot Flower and Garden Festival. I've wanted to have Ellen on for such a long time. I'm excited that she's joined us today to discuss her new book, Mythic Plants, Potions and Poisons from the Garden of the Gods. Good morning, Ellen. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Teresa.
You're just so prolific. You're hard writing. Where do you find time to write all your books?
You know, writing is just about my favorite thing to do. The only thing I like better is speaking about what I've written. I just, I love writing. Since I was in third grade, I wanted to be a writer. So what can I tell you? It's a dream come true.
I can just imagine there. That's wonderful. So the array of garden books that you've published is so eclectic and fun. So tell us about your background, because I can hear it in your voice. You're just exciting and fun to be with.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you. I tend to write about things that I love, so it's really easy for me to be enthusiastic about them. I love plants. I love food. I've written about them a lot. And since I was a kid, I was fascinated with Greek mythology, probably partly because my dad was Greek. So I say I'm Greek. I'm really only half Greek, but I'm Greek. And when you combine a love of plants and a love of Greek mythology, mythic plants just seemed like the natural thing to come out of it.
Oh, that is wonderful. So what led to nature? Were you outside a lot as a child? I know you have a little bit of theater in your background.
It's actually very funny that you mentioned the theater thing, because that's how I came to nature. I didn't like nature when I was a kid. I didn't like getting dirty. But I did Les Mis both on Broadway and the First National Tour, and I got a peace lily as an opening night gift, and that's all it took, Teresa.
Oh.
I didn't think I could grow plants, but somebody gave me a peace lily instead of a bouquet of flowers, and it all went from there. And I'm as I look around my desk right now, I'm surrounded by so many plants. It's just what I love.
You make it thrive. So your energy makes it thrive. So your philosophy on myths, how important are myths to culture and to people in general?
I think they're extremely important. And the level of importance will vary from person to person. Do I believe in the Greek gods that they really existed? No, I don't. But I love the stories. And I think whether they're real or not, sometimes the things that they teach us are very real. So even if something seems completely fictional, when you look at it, you can often find a grain of truth, especially with the plants. You look at some of these plants and the way they were used, and you're like, hey, you know what? Yarrow leaves really do have a styptic quality. They really can help heal a wound. Mm-hmm. And then you learn it was named after Achilles, and then you're like, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yarrow wound, put some yarrow on it. It just grounds the myths to look at them through the lens of horticulture, I think.
So that's fascinating. I love that. And so I have Forage the Wild Edible Plants Without Dying. It's a great book. And The Wild Crafted Cocktail. That was fun. But Mythic Plants, Potions and Poison from the Garden of the Gods. That's a tongue twister. That's okay. No, I love saying them, though. Your chapters are laid out like a banquet, from cocktails to dining to gifts. How did you select the plants you wrote about?
Well, you know, you never have enough pages to include everything that you want. So I picked the plants. I made a long list of plants that I had read about in Greek mythology and ancient Greek literature. And then I picked the ones that there were the best stories about. You know, I wanted to be able to really get people interested in the history of these plants. So if there was an interesting story, that definitely made it into the book.
That's wonderful. What was your favorite plant? Or do you have a favorite plant?
It's like asking a mother if she has a favorite child, Teresa. But I actually do. I do have a favorite plant in the book, and it's called Molly. And it was what the witch Circe used to turn Odysseus's men into pigs. And I don't want to give too much away. And I will say she probably didn't really turn the men into pigs, but there is a plant out there that would have made them think they were turned into pigs, and another plant that could have reversed that hallucination. And Molly, that's the key plant in that story, and it's a really good one.
Oh, that is true. Okay, so when you're referencing these Greek and Roman classics, do you have a favorite classic that you read often, or do you have a favorite classic philosopher that you like to read?
Not so much a philosopher, but I'm going to say I have two favorites, and I hope you'll allow that.
Sure.
I love Theophrastus because he wrote about plants. I mean, that's what he did.
Yes.
He's got five volumes that he wrote in 300 BCE, and I love his writing. But for sheer entertainment, I have to go with Herodotus, who wrote the histories. I think in about, oh gosh, I should have looked this up beforehand. I want to say the 5th century BCE, in the 400s somewhere, and he traveled all over the known world or around the Mediterranean and wrote wonderful stories about all these different cultures that people thought at the time he was making up, but excavations have proved that he was right on the money for a lot of these things, and it's just so interesting how he traveled and wrote in great detail about all these different cultures.
Well, that is fascinating. I loved, I'm a huge logophile, and as our listeners know from my Dirty Word of the Day and my top five favorite clips, I learned an unfamiliar word from you and in the chapter on dittany. So tell us about dittany and what Aristotle observed about it.
Okay, I will tell you, but then you have to tell me what the unfamiliar word is, because I looked at that chapter and I couldn't make
a
guess.
Well, dittany. I just didn't, I've never heard dittany before.
Okay, so it's the common name for Dictamnus origanum. It's a kind of oregano. And this is what I wrote down. This is what Aristotle said about it. And I quote, "Wild goats in Crete are said, when wounded by arrows, to go in search of dittany, which is supposed to have the property of ejecting arrows in the body." And the story about the Trojan War is also that when Aeneas was shot with an arrow, his mother Aphrodite brought dittany, and that was the only way they could get the arrow out of his leg. So it was believed to have these magical powers of expulsion. But personally, I just use it as a cooking herb.
So that's what I was thinking. What is a member of the oregano family? Wow, I never realized that. So what I'm fascinated about, my husband, you know, was a professor of humanities, and so he taught the myths and the classics and things. Mm-hmm. But what I'm fascinated is how did these stories get told so often that they got enveloped in the culture that everybody told the same story?
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of times people did tell the same story, but a lot of times people changed the story to fit their purposes or where they were. So you're in Florida and you might tell your story from a Floridian point of view because you need to make certain points or you need to explain something to the people in your community. And then I'm in Santa Fe, so I'm going to have a very different story about something like, let's say, the rain or the weather. Because we live in two very different places. So I'm going to take that basic story and I'm going to tweak it so it fits where I live and the message that I need to give to my people. And as for how they're passed down, I mean, it was really just the oral tradition for so many thousands of years.
Yeah.
You know, your mother would tell you how to do something and then you would tell your kids or your friends or your nieces and nephews. And, communities were tight. Communities, people stayed in their communities, and this knowledge was common. It was shared among everybody there. So it wasn't unusual to know these things.
Wow. So my favorite chapter, Ellen, was the flying herbs, and some of the herbs you mentioned are mentioned also as authentic potions in modern literature like Harry Potter series. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that herbs go through periods of use, even centuries of fame, then disappear, but then return like in the Middle Ages or during the 1960s and 70s? What makes them go and come?
So I think that's what it is. It's cyclical. They come and the knowledge is always there and some people always preserve it. But the popularity of it is what shifts up and down. And it's kind of just like fashion. Like, remember, houseplants are really big right now.
Right.
But 20, 30 years ago, when I was trying to write my first houseplant books, they weren't so popular. But then back in the 50s and 60s, they were way popular.
Yes.
So, you know, I think in the Middle Ages, came back into, you know, people used them because that's all they had.
Right.
Let's face it. But in the 60s and 70s, and I was thinking about this when you sent me the question, I think it may have been sort of the rejection of the establishment, man. Like, you know, people were resisting against something, and herbal medicine or this kind of back to the land natural idea was a way to kind of resist what they saw as the establishment that they weren't happy with. But that knowledge, that information, if we're lucky, will always be there lurking in the background.
Isn't that fun? Well, Ellen, the book is a fabulous read. It's called Mythic Plants, Potions, and Poisons from the Gardens of the Gods. Perfect summertime reading. Where can our audience get it?
Well, of course, there's Amazon and Barnes & Noble directly from Workman, which is my publisher. You can find it in independent bookstores. And if you want a signed copy, you can order one from me at mythicplants.com. And my other books are at backyardforager.com. And I'm always happy to sign a copy and put that in the mail.
Thank you so much, Ellen, for joining you. I hope to see you at a GardenCom conference soon.
That would be great, Teresa. And thank you again for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. That's Ellen Zakos. And you can get her book at all the bookstores now online, or you can go to her her website, which is mythicplants.com. She has great books. You'll enjoy reading them. She's a lot of fun, isn't she, Lizzie?
Oh, I love it. I'm gonna have to get her book and look at this, definitely.
It's Saturday morning. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins. Please hold your calls today. We have a brand new show for you to listen to, but it is pre-recorded, so we do appreciate you being here with us. We've had a lot of fun. We just had Ellen Zakos on and her book, Mythic Plants, Poisons and Potions from the Garden of the Gods. Fun book. Very interesting. I like it. It's trivia. I just love informational books, and it's just a lot of fun. She's a lot of fun, isn't she?
Oh, I loved her interview. Like, I wanted it to go on for a whole nother segment.
Yeah. So let me talk about myth. Okay. So I did have a text come in that says, hello, I use cornmeal on fire ants. They eat it and explode. No chemicals. And I just have to say, nope, cornmeal doesn't do that to ants.
Really?
It doesn't work. They don't explode. Cornmeal is a source. I mean, they can eat it and they digest it just like humans do.
Okay.
But cornmeal doesn't have anything in it that makes it explode.
But you know, there's the old wives' tale. And there's a lot of stuff that we seem to have worked at the time. So maybe the odor scared them off.
I mean, what I think gives us the impression that they eat it is that they see them carrying it away.
Okay.
You know, so, but it's causing them harm. They don't necessarily see them dying or exploding. So it doesn't cause them any harm. It's not an effective way to control ants. Better way to do it is use ant baits. Then also, you know, make sure your house, if they're in your house, there's no entry points. So baits are the best way to do it because they have the poisons and you can get natural ant baits. The University of Florida has great research on it, but ant baits work very effectively. They bring in the toxin and they take it down to the queen. Once the queen dies, the whole colony dies. So that's the issue.
Okay.
But cornmeal doesn't go pop. Corn pops. We had that for breakfast in the morning,
Love corn pops.
So, okay. So we have Linda in St. Cloud. Thank you, Linda, for a perfect text message. Once a pineapple is harvested, should I pull up the plant and replant with a new pineapple top? You can do that, Linda, if you want. But if you leave it in the ground for just about a month to 6 weeks after you harvest the pineapple, you will see that it has new pups underneath. And you'll just keep getting more and more and more. So pineapples grow exponentially. So you can just leave it in the ground and just cut off the one that is dead.
So, what breed are those pups? I'll turn my mic off. Go ahead.
Okay, so we had a great follow-up text message. I was talking in the first hour about the hibiscus and the misshapen leaves, and I said, well, it's one of two things. It's either an insect issue or a herbicide issue, and he used Roundup near the hibiscus the week before. So that was what it was. So you just got to be very careful about, wind when you're using it. It's a safe product, but on windy days, you shouldn't use it and you shouldn't edge with it and use it all the time to edge with because you're going to affect the plants around it. All right. So Teresa in Melbourne, great name, by the way.
Yes.
My mango tree is way too big. Can I trim it down? And how much is too much? Thanks. You can trim it down to where you're comfortable with it. And, trim it by a third. You're not going to see anything wrong with it. If it's a tall tree, it's already established. I would say cut it by a third, whether it's density or whether it's just the top of it off. And the wintertime probably will help you take care of it, too. It'll knock it down a little bit, too, if it freezes there. And so let's see. What else? Where are we going to go here? Let me use my mouse here. You're listening today to a pre-recorded show. These are the questions, the text messages that we've gotten in. But as a rule, we take phone calls and text messages live on the air. So confirm, what is the iHeart radio channel I can listen to live?
Yes, what you can do is you can search on the iHeart app. You can search WFLF, or you can go to WFLA Orlando.com to listen live. And then if you want to recap anything that Teresa said or any other shows, go to betterlawns.com and you can find all of our podcasts there.
Exactly. Or anywhere where you listen to podcasts.
Exactly.
That's great. So thank you, Linda, for listening. We know you're out there today, so we do appreciate you. That's Linda from Zone 8B, and she is out there. So thank you. Have a wonderful week, too. We will do it ourselves. So then I have a message from, Matt in Sebring. And he says, last year I planted 2 6-foot-tall eastern redbuds that have died back. Presently, there's only one healthy branch about 18 inches up above appears dead. No green and scratch test. Should I cut the trunk off above the healthy branch? Yes. Yes, because you're not going to get any new growth unless you cut it. Cut it diagonally. Cut it with a sterile tool and see if it comes back. I don't know why it died or the rest of or the other one died, but I'd like to know. And you can try and see it. I don't know if it's you can save it, Matt, but I wish you good luck. Yeah, yes, you can cut it. Please do, by all means. So, Lizzie, we do appreciate having Ellen Zakos on and also Jenks Farmer on today. We do really do appreciate it. They both got great books, Secrets to Southern Gardening, and also Mythic Plants, Poisons and Potions from the Garden of the Gods. There, I got it. We do appreciate them coming on. We do appreciate all our sponsors and also our listeners. We've got great listeners out there. It's Saturday morning from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. You're listening to a pre-recorded show today, so hold all of your calls and text messages. We'll be back next week. I want to say lovely to hear from Linda, Zone 8B. Thank you very much. Have a great week yourself. Thank you so much for being such a loyal fan. And then Matt in Sebring. Last year, he says, I planted 2 6-foot-tall eastern redbuds that have died back. Presently, there's only one healthy branch about 18 inches above what appears dead. No green in the scratch test. Should I cut the trunk off above the healthy branch? Yes. There's no problem in doing it. I don't know if it's going to survive, Matt, or not, but you can go ahead and do it and just keep watering it. Make sure that you're seeing, look for a new sprout coming off. And so I'd like to know if it came back. I don't know why it died, but if you want to cut it off, there's no problem in it. So we want to say thank you to our interviews today. Ellen Zakos from Mythic Plants, Poisons and Potions from the Garden of the Gods. Fun book to read. You can get it at mythicplants.com. And then Jenks Farmer. I just love having him on. Today were two great guests. I just love hanging around them and yes, being with them. They're so much fun. Jenks Farmer, his new book, Secrets to Southern Gardening, and it's Pro Tips for Success. And it's a great book about Southern Gardening. It explains it for new gardeners, and it's a great book. And you can get that book at jenksfarmer.com. Jenksfarmer.com, and you spell Jenks, J-E-N-K-S. Farmer, F-A-R-M-E-R, and his last name fits him. It's just wonderful how that works.
And he has so much energy because he's been in this building before.
Yeah.
And I just, if you feel like you're feeling down, all you got to do is just spend less than 2 seconds, especially an elevator ride up with him, and you are going to feel like a brand new person.
I tell you what, and isn't that what gardening does for all of us? And
it really does.
You got to get out there and just take in the fresh air and breathe it, and you'll feel better. And dig in the dirt, and you don't have to dig in it long, and especially you drink water and just stay out there like 30 minutes, that's all. But if you get a couple of hours out in the garden a week, you're going to feel so much better. So we do appreciate all of our people that come on the show and the sponsor of our show, Black Cow, great product, wonderful to use, and they are sponsors. Quality Green Specialist. In DeLand on Michigan Street, you definitely want to go by there and thank them for, sponsoring the show. Also, Peterson's Nursery in Lakeland, thank you so much. They have great webinars each week. Go by. You will not leave there without buying a plant. I'm just telling you, you're taking a plant home.
100%. And I got a secret text from Howie about a week ago, and he says that they're in the doing their roses and they're getting ready for next year. Okay, now we got like 6 months till you know we're going to see these roses and be able to purchase them from Peterson's Nursery.
Yes.
However, I love that he gives me updates because let me tell you, you want to talk about some smell good roses and some pretty roses. They got some pretty and some smell good roses for sure.
They're wonderful. So we do appreciate them. And then Summit Responsible Solutions Studios, great sponsors. For our studios and iHeart Studios, and they just make great products that are safe for the environment, but do the job. And so no mosquitoes, no ticks, no fleas, and no harm to the environment.
Yes,
so
definitely. And we're going to be gearing up here for hunting season.
Exactly.
So that green armor you can spray on your boots, your pants, your tenting, your tents, your blind area. Well, I mean, I don't know. Say you know you don't want to put any smells out for deer and stuff.
Because, no, well, I'm telling you, I was in this.
Good.
Well, this week I was in an HOA, and I'm telling my husband, I'm going, well, they have a deer issue. He's going, really? Here, a deer issue in Florida? I go, yeah, they kind of have a deer issue. And it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and here come like three deer just sauntering down the road, just walking through the landscape, and he's going, I've never seen a deer that close before.
That is hysterical. And he's a New England boy,
yeah,
too. So basically to him, our deer are just like little pet dogs.
And they were just wandering through a taller one and a couple of smaller ones. But they were just wandering through. They looked at us and said, you know, hi, we're over here. You know, have a good day.
You know, the coolest thing to see is whenever you get to see a fawn, because yes. Then you get to see the little white dots on their back and booty.
I just think they're so cool. But they eat everything. They're just so bad. So saying that, if you want to have my publication on what deer will not eat or deer resistant plants, go ahead and email me at my website. Teresa.Watkins@live.com, and I will send that to you.
And roses are not one of them, so don't think that they love roses and thorns. That's their
thorns is fiber.
Yes, those are candy. Like yes, so
yeah, roses. Yeah, that's too funny. And they will eat anything. I mean, it just if they're starving and there's no and we're having a drought and there's not a lot of good food for them to eat, they will eat anything. And sometimes, like loropetalums, they were supposed to not be. They were supposed to be deer resistant, but I've seen them, it's kind of like, well, we've looked at that for 2 years and, let's try it. Well, mm-hmm. We kind of don't like it, but it's like me giving Brussels sprouts to my children. I gave them one at a time, during a meal. And I just say, just eat one. And they, oh, I don't like it. But guess what? My kids love Brussels sprouts now.
Now I've got a question. How many Brussels sprouts did you actually cook? Knowing that they were only going to eat one at a time. Now, would make like a big
No, because I will eat 8, 9, or 10 of them. Yeah, myself. I love Brussels sprouts.
Gosh.
I cook mine in chicken broth.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Chicken broth, and then we can saute them with onions and bacon and stuff. So it's not just a Brussels sprout. I don't eat them like that. But they grew up, and they like, to eat Brussels sprouts now. But, that's like deer. They don't like that. No, they won't eat it. But if you eat something once every year, eventually you get to like it.
And the thing is that your one son who has the restaurant up in St. Augustine, mm-hmm.
A couple of them now.
Oh, yeah, I know. Does he serve Brussels sprouts?
Yes, he does.
And does he like, are they like covered in bacon?
Yeah, he makes fancy Brussels sprouts, yes.
Fancy? With a little bit of Parmesan sprinkled on top.
I will tell you, we had lamb. Oh my God, that was just big. It was amazing. We ate for three meals. It was enough for three meals.
I believe it. 100%. What's the name of his place?
River and Fort and Saint. See, River and Fort and Saint.
And I've been there before, and he didn't know I was there or anything. So, but I love it. The staff and this the view, it was just beautiful.
It was gorgeous. Yes. Right across from the Castillo de San Marcos. So we do. Yes, it's good when your son's a chef.
Now, I got a question. We're about this time of year of planting, and this listeners, listen to this. This blew my mind. When are we supposed to plant our little seeds so we have the little meadows of wildflowers?
We're supposed to plant them in the fall and winter time.
Thank you.
Okay.
I was totally blown away because whenever spring rolls around, all of a sudden all these the beautiful meadows and driving down the side of the road and everything, you see them, but they plant them in the fall.
Right. So it just depends on what kind of wildflowers there are. Some are, you can plant during the summertime, but during the summer we get so much rain. And as you know, wildflowers grow without any kind of human intervention except for planting them. But they're it's based on the rainfall. And we get so much rain in the summertime that sometimes they can rot. The seeds rot. And so they never germinate. And so in the wintertime, it is dry. And then they start to get the spring, a little bit of rain. And it's enough for them. So wildflowers, you can go ahead and plant them in the fall. So I'm getting ready to do that for a couple of clients. And now we're doing wildflower meadows. You know, on top of drain fields, we're just putting wildflower meadows.
I'm so excited for that. I think that's great.
I love the fall.
Yeah, too,
so thank you, Lizzie, for producing the show. We do appreciate it. We have to thank all of our listeners. We do love them.
Yes, we have the best listeners. So thank you so much. And thanks for sharing the show, too.
Yes, please. If you know someone who's new to Florida, get them to listen and watch the myths, okay? Just call and ask us if it's true or not, okay? So we don't... we just want to make
sure
you...
Stop feeding the ants cornmeal. Hey, I did it, too. So.
From the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios, if it's Saturday morning, you're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network.
If you missed any of this show or any of our other shows, you can catch it on the podcast at betterlawns.com. That's betterlawns.com.